I'd like to call the session of the interim task force for primary care and behavioral health reimbursement to order. Like to welcome our panel. This is the first meeting of this task force, so we're going to do a fair amount of organizational work today and actually a little bit of getting to know one another as we begin to look at this work. This will be recorded for the sessions that we will have of the task force meeting so that people are aware of that. And it looks like we're getting all of our members present. We do have at least two members that will not be in attendance today. Representative Lively and also Dr. Gluckman will not be present with us today. So we'd like to take a moment to do some introductions of the group. And so at this point, we're going to start our organizational meeting. Following the organizational meeting, we will, which I will now gavel in, we will then proceed with our informational meeting, and that will be our time of discussion. So the organizational meeting has come to order, and I'd like to start with introductions. And so we're going to start from my left to the right and introduce ourselves. We'd like to make sure each of the panelists are also aware of why we are here, what we do, and what our passion is around the work that we have ahead of ourselves. So I'm going to start with Dr. Smith.
Okay. Why am I here? I'm Janine Smith, the Chief Medical Officer for the Oregon Health Authority, and I oversee the Office of Health Policy and Research. I'm a family physician by training, still seeing patients a half a day a week in a federally qualified health center.
I'm Ruth Bauman. I'm the CEO of Atrio Health Plan. I am also the board chair for WBCH, the local CCO here in Salem.
I'm Robin Henderson. I'm a licensed psychologist by trade. I'm the director of government strategies and the chief behavioral health officer at St. Charles Health System in Bend, Oregon.
I'm Julie Parrish. I'm a state representative from House District 37, West Flint and Tualatin, sponsor of this House bill, which brought us here.
Great. Rick Kincaid, I'm a family physician in Eugene, practice 2 days a week, and then I have an administrative role in which I oversee community-based care and primary care for the Lane County. I'm a board member of our the CCO in Lane County and also participate in several of the organizations within the community, particularly dealing with behavioral health and primary care integration, and that's the reason that I attend this meeting.
I'm Mary Grant. I'm a nurse practitioner for the Providence Health System in Portland, Oregon. I do palliative care and end-of-life discussions with patients. I'm here on behalf of the nurse practitioners in the state of Oregon and NPO and ONA.
I'm Lori Monis Anderson, state senator from Gresham, Trout, Delwood Village, and Fairview. I chair the Senate Health Care Committee, and I am a registered nurse.
I'm Senator Tim Canope from Redmond, Tumalo, Bend, and Sun River, and I'm here because I love to serve people and solve problems.
Cora Lee Koning, also known as Corey, physician assistant with Providence Medical Group in Providence, Portland, and also up in Washington, president-elect for the Oregon Society of PAs, and I have a real big heart for family medicine and behavioral health.
John Prassis, Vice President of Network Management for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, based in Portland, Oregon.
Sean Colmer, Governor's Policy Advisor.
Very good. I want to welcome everyone. For our task force, Mary and I will serve as co-chairs. As the legislation was set out, pointed out, chair and vice chair. We have chosen to have a co-chair relationship as we feel that our partnership is going to be critical to making sure we get a productive product out of this time. So we will share some of our duties. The next item on the agenda is a set of proposed rules, and this is rules to help us as we proceed forth over the next several meetings. So before you are a set of proposed rules for the task force. Do I need to list off the rules?
No.
Chair, I move to adopt the proposed rules dated 1-17-14.
Very good. Senator Moniz. Senator Anderson moves to adopt the proposed task force rules. These are dated January 17, 2014. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections to these rules? Seeing none, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. So we will now bring to order our informational meeting. And to set this up, as Mary and I have looked at this work, neither of us have been involved in the legislation that actually led to the creation of this task force. And we're not able to hear the actual testimony during House Bill 2902. As a result, there are likely other panel members as well that have not had that opportunity. And so we wanted to take a step back and actually look at the why this bill was brought forth, and then the creation of the bill, its evolution, and then eventual product, which was definitely different than the initial bill that came out at the start. So to begin that, what we would have asked is really some of the key people that were involved in House Bill 2902 to give us some background. And to do that, we have representatives from the Oregon Nurses Association, a representative from really the insurance function, Cambia Health Solutions, Tom Holt. He will be actually joining us, I believe, by phone. And then we also have representative from the Oregon Medical Association. And so we'll start with the Oregon Nursing Association. Sarah Basler is going to present the position of the Oregon Nurses Association. Then we'll follow with Brian Boehringer, who is going to give the position from the Oregon Medical Association, and then we'll follow that with Mr. Holt. So, Sarah?
Great. Thank you very much. Co-Chair Grant, Co-Chair Kincaid, and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Basler. I'm the Director of Health Policy and Government Relations at the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm pleased to be here today and hoping to be able to give you some background on this issue from our perspective, a little bit of the history behind the bill, how we got to where we were, and why we went through the fairly long and complicated legislative process that we did. The Oregon Nurses Association represents about 12,000 registered nurses, as well as a couple hundred nurse practitioners throughout the state. I know many of you are familiar with nurse practitioners, but for anybody who isn't, Oregon nurse practitioners have earned a broad scope of practice. They practice independently without being under the supervision of a physician. They, in most scenarios, bill insurers under their own name as well. In a primary care mental health setting, they perform many of the same functions that a physician would. They can diagnose and treat and manage illnesses. They prescribe and dispense medications, order and interpret tests, and provide a full range of primary and preventive services. Nurse practitioners are licensed and regulated by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. They have extensive training and education, although it certainly varies depending on the path that someone has taken. In most cases, a nurse practitioner has a minimum of 6 to 8 years of nursing education. In some cases, it's certainly much beyond that. We work with our nurse practitioner members on a variety of policy and practice issues. The issue that we're here about today first came to our attention in 2009. We started getting phone calls from NPs. At this point in time, the NPs who were calling us were psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners. They had been notified by one of the major insurance carriers that their rates were being reduced. In many cases, it was a pretty significant double-digit reduction. This started with one carrier, and unfortunately, it quickly spread. Another large carrier that had a large state contract soon cut rates again. So for especially for providers who had a lot of their patients covered by one of the carriers who had cut, the overall impact on their bottom line and on their small business that they're running, it made a big difference. This issue first came to the legislature in 2010. There was an interim hearing that year. Since that hearing, it became more and more clear that the cuts they had seen at that point that were still mainly in mental health and coming from two carriers, those cuts were the start of the trend, and it spread. Over the next couple of years, we heard from more and more NPs whose rates were being reduced. I want to mention that the rate reductions weren't based on the performance of the provider or the outcomes of patients. The cuts impacted nurse practitioners, they impacted physician assistants, they impacted a variety of other professionals, largely in the mental health area as well. In some cases, the notifications to the providers came in company newsletters from the insurers. In no case that we're aware of was the reduction negotiated with the provider that was impacted. By 2011, we saw the cuts that started in mental health start to impact primary care nurse practitioners as well. I want to be very clear that not every carrier made cuts. Even the carriers who did cut didn't necessarily cut across the board. So we could have an NP who had a rate cut in one part of the state, and another part of the state maybe not. In our experience, we heard from nurse practitioners in both urban and rural and the areas in between who had their rates reduced. In most scenarios, the NPs who reported significant reductions were more likely to be in a solo practice or a very small practice. In 2011, we did a survey of NPs. About 15% reported that they'd seen some sort of reduction from private insurance carriers. They did report to us consistently that private insurance reimbursement was one of their top concerns, and were able to demonstrate that the cuts from the insurers had a variety of impacts on their practice. Some reported working more hours. Others reported an overall cut in their income. And as an example of that, a psychiatric mental health NP here in the Salem area reported that despite seeing the same number of patients, between 2009 and 2010, her overall reimbursement fell 15%. So, some rates stayed the same. Some providers was a 25% cut. There was a range of cuts, but her overall impact was a 15% reduction. By 2011, her overall reduction was 30 to 35% lower than what she'd brought in 2009, and that's seeing roughly the same number of patients. Other NPs reported that the cuts made them make the decision to resign from certain insurance panels. So, and that's, that's one of the examples of how this impacts patient access to care. When a provider chooses to resign from an insurance panel and go to a cash basis, their patient can either pay cash or find care somewhere else. I think as everyone here knows, in certain parts of the state, there's a provider shortage. So if you're trying to find mental health care in a rural or even an urban part of the state, your provider goes to a cash pay basis, you can't afford to pay cash. It's a very tough situation for patients, and it's a very hard choice for providers to make. As an example of that, this is another example from a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. This one was in Central Oregon. Some of her reimbursement rates were cut 25%. This is a provider who had a specialty training and expertise in treating children who had complicated psychiatric conditions. She practices in a part of the state that doesn't have a lot of psychiatric providers. She chose to see fewer kids because ultimately the reduced reimbursement rates didn't cover her business expenses. She's also someone who, she's been in private practice for about 7 years. Twice during that time, a psychiatrist left town and transferred most of his patients into her care. So we'll fast forward a little bit to get to the legislative history of this. As most of you know, ONA introduced a series of bills on this issue starting in 2011. Those bills all varied a little bit. I'm not going to get into the details of all of them. In 2013, House Bill 2902, which is what has brought all of us here today, was focused on primary care and mental health. I'll remind you, these are the areas where we've seen the cuts, and these are also areas where there's a very clear concern about patients' ability to access care. This bill required that private insurers reimburse nurse practitioners and physician assistants the same rate as physicians when they provide the same service and bill with the same code. All of our proposed legislative solutions over the years dealt with situations in which the NP is providing the same service as a physician and billing the private insurance company using the same billing code. So I covered this a little bit earlier, but NPs can provide and bill for largely the same services. That's all billing's done based on a code. So, you know, if an NP or a physician is seeing a patient who's more complicated, that would be coded differently. If it's in psychiatric care, if you're spending a different amount of time with a patient, that's coded differently. So I want to be very clear that, again, using psychiatric care as an example, a 30-minute visit with someone with a mild, well-managed case of depression is going to be coded, billed, and reimbursed differently than a 90-minute visit with a suicidal patient who's hearing voices and on a number of psychiatric medications. I also want to be very clear about the fact that this bill and those that preceded it were never meant to have any adverse impact on physicians. You know, ONA recognizes that we need a wide range of providers to meet the healthcare needs of Oregonians. We value the work of our physician colleagues and believe that nurse practitioners, physicians, and others are all part of the network of providers that we'll need to take care of everyone. Before I wrap up, I just wanted to identify some of perhaps the common misperceptions about the bill and about the solution that we ultimately sought. I think a lot of people have some assumptions about the outcomes of patients treated by one type of provider or another. Decades of data have consistently shown that nurse practitioner outcomes are comparable to physician outcomes. The 2011 systematic review of published literature from 1990 to 2008 found that the outcomes of care provided by advanced practice nurses like nurse practitioners were similar and in some ways exceeded care provided by physicians alone. In 2012, the National Governors Association highlighted NP outcomes and recommended that states expand utilization of NPs, and one of their recommendations was assuring adequate reimbursement. Another common misperception is that NPs see the easy patients, the ones that aren't sick enough to need to go to, that aren't sick enough to see a different type of provider. While on any given day or in any given appointment, an NP could see an easier patient than a physician, or I would point out the other way around, data presented in the Institute of Medicine report on the future of nursing shows a minimal degree of variation in the complexity of patients seen by different types of providers. And again, I would remind us all that the billing codes build in the complexity of the patient and the care provided. So in cases where the care is different, the coding would be different, and therefore it wouldn't fall into this the reimbursement structure created by this bill. Finally, I just want to touch on the connection to healthcare reform. You know, as part of this process, we talked a lot about fee-for-service reimbursement. ONA is eager to move to a different system. We're happy to talk about moving to a system based on outcomes. But again, you know, this is something that's probably not going to happen overnight. And based on what we've seen with the trend from insurers starting back in 2009 of cutting rates, we needed to have a solution that created a fair reimbursement structure and ensured that patients had appropriate access to care. So I will wrap up with that. ONA looks forward to continuing the conversation in this task force and remains committed to finding a long-term solution that ensures access and treats providers fairly. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Baser at this point?
Great. Co-Chair Grant, Co-Chair Kincaid, members of the task force, my name is Brian Behringer. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Oregon Medical Association. First off, I'd like the OMA and all of us would like to thank you all for volunteering your time to participate in this very important policy discussion. This was a very tough issue for us, and I think Sarah alluded to that. Many OMA members work side by side with nurse practitioners. We work even closer with physician assistants, and many PAs are even members of the OMA. These are our colleagues, and they are a valuable part of the healthcare team, and the patient care they provide is important to ensuring access to healthcare for all Oregonians. Additionally, we believe that the MPs and the PAs raised legitimate issues and concerns that their rates were drastically reduced, and we wanted to help them find a solution to this. We were, however, concerned that the solution that was proposed in House Bill 2902 was broad and was not thoroughly discussed by all the stakeholders the new policy could possibly impact. Because of the pressure of session deadlines, this issue missed out on a full vetting, and now this task force has the opportunity to have a thoughtful policy discussion on the subject of payment reform. The Oregon Medical Association was part of a coalition of provider groups that raised several concerns. For the sake of background, I'll mention some of the bigger concerns our members raised. The solution offered in the original House Bill 2902 was out of step with Oregon's healthcare reform efforts. As we continue to move aggressively towards a more efficient healthcare system in the state, and we recognize the advantage of team-based care in these efforts, mandating reimbursement in this way props up the current fee-for-service system that the state's reform efforts within coordinated care organizations coordinated care organizations continues to encourage patient-centered team-based care with comprehensive payment reform that emphasizes outcomes. Mandating the same pay for all physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants in primary care and mental health, regardless of practice setting or location, could actually increase health care costs at a time when Oregon is seeking to drastically reduce health care expenditures. Additionally, we were concerned that mandating the same pay for nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and physicians would not limit a commercial insurer from decreasing a physician's rates to align with those of a nurse practitioner and physician assistant. To prevent this outcome, we proposed the provision that was included in the final bill that would prevent insurers from meeting this new requirement by lowering physician payments. The solution proposed in House Bill 2902 doesn't also account for the differences between the practices of a physician and a nurse practitioner or physician assistant, or for the higher operating costs that physicians incur due to professional liability insurance premiums, licensure, and training. There were also concerns raised about payment parity would undervalue the training required by practicing physicians and the expertise they bring to patient care. Many were concerned that this would also create significant disincentives for new physicians to choose to practice in Oregon, since every other state recognizes the different levels of training through reimbursement. Because of our members' concerns with the proposed solution, we pushed for the inclusion of the task force and the sunset on the underlying policy to create an opportunity for the stakeholders to get around the table, like we are today, and talk about the problem and come up with possible solutions. Not only does the task force provision and sunset give this group an opportunity to do some additional work on this issue, it also gives us a chance to collect data on the proposed solution to see how well it works, given that we're under the temporary or the current proposal that ONA pursued. As you begin your work on this issue, we do believe that mental health and primary care bring different issues and concerns to the table, and we would strongly encourage you to collect input from each of these groups of providers and include them in your work. We believe during the session, and we continue to believe, that if the providers, payers, and other impacted parties could get around a policy table, that they might be able to come up with a better mousetrap to solve this problem. That solution would build on the health reforms that the state is currently pursuing and wouldn't continue to tie us to the old fee-for-service system that health reform is working so hard to replace. While this was a tough issue on many of us, we believe that this group working together can find a collaborative solution that fairly addresses the reimbursement problem and doesn't create new problems in recruiting and retaining primary care and mental health physicians in Oregon. Again, we thank you for volunteering for this very important work, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Brian had one related to others. Oregon being the only state in which there is parity currently as of the passage of 2902.
During the legislative co-chair Kincaid, during the legislative session when we checked on it, it was the only state with passage of it. I know it was being discussed in a couple of states, but we haven't checked that since the end of our session, so we can do that. And maybe Sarah has some more updated information.
Co-Chair Kincaid, Co-Chair Grant, as far as I'm aware, Oregon's the first state in the nation, and nobody else has done it quite yet.
Any other questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Nurse practitioners in Oregon, were we the first state to have nurse practitioners be able to prescribe, be able to basically work independently?
Co-Chair Grant and Kincaid.
I can probably answer that with the help of Jack and Sarah. I think we were one of the first. It was in the mid-70s when we first got our prescriptive privileges, of course, working with the legislature. And so I want to say yes. I mean, we're a model to the rest of the country as far as being able to write prescriptions and have a scope of practice.
Yes, Oregon has historically led the nation, and if we weren't the first, we've been close to it in many of these things.
Any additional comment or questions?
I have a question. I'm relatively new to Oregon. I actually moved here in August, so this question is more out of curiosity. Are there any hospitals in the state that allow a nurse practitioner to be the attending physician on a inpatient case?
Actually, they do.
Yeah.
The Providence Health System many years ago created a credentialing program that, for instance, when I apply for my privileges at Providence, I have to go before the credentialing committee. They decide what my scope will be. In some cases, depending on where the practice is, not necessarily in this, in the Portland area, but in many settings, they're the admitting physician. They have admitting privileges now. It means going through the same process that a physician would go through for credentialing, education, all of those sort of things, but they can.
So that would be at the forefront of the country, too, and I don't think that that's a standard practice in most states.
No.
Okay.
Again, that's typically a medical staff function, and with the expanded workforce of both physician assistants and nurse practitioners being a critical part now to the inpatient function, many medical staffs have very clear credentialing systems related to those providers, many of who can be attendings. Also on the outpatient side, many nurse practitioners serve as the primary care provider or PCP, as designated by an insurer. Okay. So great. On the phone, I'm hoping we have Mr. Tom Holt.
I'm here.
Very, very good. We have you. You're looking slim, trim, sort of dark and flat, really, at this point. But we have you right in the center of the podium here, and so you have the floor, sir.
All right, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your indulging me in needing to call in. I'm Tom Holt, and I'm Director of Government Affairs for Cambia Health Solutions, which you may better know, members of the panel, as the holding company of Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield and of Bridgespan, which is a new company doing business in health insurance exchanges as well as other health-related endeavors. We were involved in the bill along with other insurers, and you've heard good background from my colleagues Sarah and Brian about how this came about. I can fill in a little bit more context from a payer perspective. We share the concern of many of the adequacy of the primary care workforce in our state. I know the state has looked at this over the years, and pretty much the conclusion has been consistently that there are not enough in almost any mid-level or higher-level licensee to provide care everywhere that it's needed, and that's a concern that we share. We also strongly believe that there is a very appropriate role for nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and other mid-level providers in the healthcare delivery system. They bring a lot to the table in being able to provide care very efficiently and at a very good level to people who need it in both physical health and mental health. For us, from a payment perspective, we're asked questions, hard questions all the time by our customers who are paying the bills ultimately, how can we deliver care most efficiently, through the providers that we contract with. Things started to change around nurse practitioner reimbursement a few years ago when Medicare actually took the first step in reducing their expectation of reimbursement to a relative payment of around 80% for a nurse practitioner compared to a primary care physician. And, you know, many carriers followed that in part because we have to meet our requirements with Medicare in our Medicare Advantage products. And so the assumptions that Medicare makes in their contracts with us reflect those different reimbursement rates. When the Nurses Association brought this measure forward, while we agreed that it's very important to have the right incentives in place for people to participate in primary care, we didn't entirely agree with the solution. We had customers raising concerns that, well, gee, are the groups of patients similar as the other providers, and other questions related to that, and really bottom line from their perspective was, you know, look, is this going to end up costing us more? Now, we don't know the answer to that question yet, but you know, there's it stands to reason that with a requirement that there be equal pay for these groups of providers, that there will be some additional cost involved. Our hope in this endeavor that you are all undertaking is that we look more broadly beyond even the two sets of licensees addressed by the bill, and look at what model of primary care payment is going to provide the right incentives. There's been some good work, early work done in this state on primary care homes. We've been involved in that. We were one of the handful of health plans that engaged a project in collaboration with the federal government to establish primary care homes. We also were engaged in a private sector project where we funded nurse practitioners in a relatively small number of sites, but to really see if a particular model of primary care home delivery would provide the kind of results that intuitively I think we all believe are helpful to have, sort of a quarterback of the more complex patients in it within a practice to make sure that all patients getting connected with all the methods of care and all the services that they need and have the proper follow-ups and so on. So I think we would encourage looking at this at a higher level of beyond the specifics of fee-for-service codes, where, as Brian mentioned, and we're already into an environment where the system is changing in some innovative and we hope very positive ways of encouraging providers to agree to incentives for the total cost of care and the total help of each person, rather than traditional fee for service, essentially piecework. And at a policy level, it is concerning to us to have in statute something that's really tied to a system that everyone seems to agree is broken. So we look forward to being involved in your work to see what model potentially can we agree on that moves the whole system in the right direction and encourages all providers to look at Oregon as a good place to visit, not visit, but to practice. For those of you who remember Tom McCall, I think what we're aiming for is the opposite of the infamous sign of visit but don't stay. We would like people to stay and practice, whether it's a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, a psychiatrist, or a physician. So with that, that really summarizes, I think, our view on this, and would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions for Mr. Holt?
I have a question. This is Ruth Bauman. Mr. Hull, did I hear you correctly that you had customers who actually questioned the reimbursement for nurse practitioners?
Yes. We had, as this legislation got a fair amount of attention in the media, we had some of our customers ask us about what would be the impact of this, and their, you know, at least their first impressions were very concerned.
Mr. Holt, this is Rick Kincaid. I wanted to thank you for the acknowledgement of the fact that we don't want to create a transient workforce in medical care. Our experience is that, at least in our region, that has actually become a factor. We are more and more dependent on locums, more and more dependent on folks that are only intending to practice for a very short time in Oregon. So, again, I appreciate your intention representing insurers that, in fact, you'd like to have a stable workforce. So, thank you. I'd like to open also for Dr. Smith.
Yeah. Tom, this is Janine Smith. Question, you said that Medicare had decreased down to 80% of docs. That was in their fee-for-service, correct? And then you felt that you needed to do that inside your Medicare Advantage product? I thought there was flexibility inside the Medicare Advantage to pay. I know that in the past our fully capped, and now our CCOs have flexibility on how they negotiate their provider networks. So is there an obligation in the Medicare Advantage that you must pay what they're paying in Medicare fee for service?
Did you hear that, Tom?
Well, in answer to your question, while in Medicare Advantage, we are not, you know, it's not a direct kind of checkbox follow specific requirement embedded in their payment to us in Medicare Advantage is that assumption, and so we, you know, it reflects the overall expectations of Medicare, and so we do feel that we were as an industry somewhat obliged to follow their lead on that.
This is Co-Chair Mary Grant. I know that the 100% has been around for quite some time, but I also do know that there are provider groups, physicians who went to bat for the nurse practitioners, you know, and went to some of the larger insurance companies and said, why are you going to reimburse them 20% less? At one point is because, well, you know, nurse practitioners probably refer out more, but they were never able to prove that we referred out to consultants more. And so in a lot of cases, the insurer would go ahead and reimburse at 100%. It depended on who the nurse practitioner worked with at the time. So, but this was quite a while ago.
Well, I understand that, you know, this has been one of the contentious background pieces to this. As Ms. Baylor stated while they've had reports of nurse practitioners, you know, reducing the practice and so on, for at least for us, and this was something that we looked at, and the question was, you know, are we losing providers in our network as a result of this trend? And the answer that we got back, at least in the Regents networks, was that no, we had great stability, and we had not had issues of our customers and members obtaining access. Now, that said, and those we cover do not include the CCO population. There are other carriers in the market, and they may have had a different experience depending on the decisions that they made in their contracting. Our result in particular isn't necessarily reflective of the entire industry, but there's certainly different perspectives on this. And I think one of the challenges for this task force is to help us to get a better picture of what do the data overall show I think one of the challenges, you know, all three of us who are here today had during the session last year was that to varying degrees, we were often working off of anecdotes rather than complete data and up-to-date data. And you know, one of the things that I think would be helpful in sort of answering this question of, you know, what is a model that will provide the appropriate incentives is getting our arms around what does the workforce look like now, where are the access issues, and what is the nature of them, and things of that nature that you know, with the greater amount of time and to investigate and deliberate than what's available in a session environment, hopefully we can arrive at good answers. The answer may well be by the time we get to the end of this process that the legislation that passes is a start. You may come to a different conclusion. I don't know. And I'm delighted that you've all, and we're delighted as the company that you're, have all agreed to volunteer a significant amount of your time and that, your employers have allowed you to take the time to participate in this.
I would like to open up an opportunity. We have two of the senators that were actually sponsors of the legislation. Was there anything you would, either Tim, you or would like to add? Either of you would like to add? You're listed on the bill as sponsors, and so I know you know a fair amount about this. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I think that the information has been pretty well presented. It's always very difficult, since I am, I must say, a little biased toward nurses and nurse practitioners because I've worked with them and know the quality of work, and there's care that was being given to patients that wouldn't have been given just due to the nature of where the clinics are located in the state, and therefore to harm when they are delivering the same quality care in a particularly a rural area, but even in a FQHC, federally qualified health center, it's very hard to recruit physicians into rural areas, into federally qualified health systems. There tends to be more nurse practitioners that serve the Medicaid population. So that's why access is the primary key here. And so we do not want to have anything in the state of Oregon that's going to stop access for our patients, and I think that's about the only thing I would like to add at this point.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do agree with Senator Mona Sanderson on that, and look forward to studying this issue as broadly in scope as the bill allows us to do, because I think it's a really important issue, and it is an issue of access and for the ability of many of these what I consider small business owners to stay in business.
Unfortunately, we lost Representative Parrish for a bit, but we'll hopefully get her input as well as being a sponsor. Sean?
I just want to thank Brian and Sarah and the respective folks who worked on this, because I know this wasn't an easy issue. It's been dealt with the last couple of sessions. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a good start that we're all here today to figure out how to work together to make this work. You're hearing the same themes from everybody, so hopefully with a little more time, we can get to a good place where everybody can agree to. So thank you guys for mm-hmm. getting us here.
Very much so. And Dan, you could hear similar themes in each of the discussions. I think there is quite a bit of general agreement, and I think it's that commonality that we have of trying to effectively deliver health care in Oregon that will allow us to make the right choices. And I think that's the intention, certainly. We have asked for a time just to get the real clarity around our requirements and the language that was placed in and finally approved in House Bill 2902. To do that, Lori Freeman is here, who is a senior deputy legislative counsel, and we've asked Lori to come to tell us the real stuff that we're required to do, and then we're going to take that and a step back and say, what can we do? So,
Tom?
Yes?
You're welcome to stay on the line, but if you choose to go off and do other things, but just... If you disconnect, I will disconnect you.
Okay. I'll stay on as long as I can.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks.
We don't want you to lose the opportunity for further education and enlightenment. So,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair,
yes.
Before Lori starts, I do want to make the comment that this has been focused primarily around nurse practitioners and physician assistants, but... we do have psychiatrists, we do have psychologists, we do have mental health therapists, mental health specialists, and so we know that reimbursements have to include all of these providers. So, you know, clinical social workers are being driven out by rate cuts. And maybe there needs to be a pecking order. I don't know, you know, that's for us to decide, but a tiered approach could maybe be a fairest when we're taking it to a much broader scope. So I think that we cannot forget those other providers that are delivering health care. Thank you.
Point very well taken. The complexity of the workforce in both primary care and behavioral health care is changing, and there are new providers of care entering different aspects of care, particularly as we look at team-based models. So I think as we go forward, I would agree that we have to look at who is on the team, how do we most appropriately reimburse in a fashion to support that team-based model. So your point well taken. Lori.
Hi, I'm Lori Freeman with the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I really can't say much more than what's already contained in Section 3, paragraph subsection 2, that says the task force shall study and make recommendations for a payment structure for the reimbursement by insurers of licensed physicians, physician assistants, and certified nurse practitioners. The payment structure must promote the maintenance and expansion of the primary care and mental health care workforce in the state and ensure that all primary care and mental health practitioners are compensated fairly. And while it's limited to recommendations about reimbursements of licensed physicians, physicians assistants, and certified nurse practitioners, I think Sarah Moss Anderson is correct that you can look beyond that, because the second sentence basically is looking at a whole compensation structure so that all primary care and mental health practitioners in the state are compensated fairly.
Good. And could you also just make sure there's clarity around the period of time in which we have established that relationship of parity and payment? When does that actually sunset?
Well, the changes to the bill that were agreed to at the last session, those sunset on January 1st, 2018.
Okay. But the task force.
And the term of the task force?
The task force ends on the convening of the 2016 regular session. So that would be like February something of 2016.
So, any questions? We can solve the entire payment reform for the state in the next 24 months.
I wish you would.
Lori, is there an obligation right now for pay parity? Because it says something about contracts started as of 2 weeks ago. So
correct.
So currently there is, the payments have changed? or are obligated to change. Is that true?
The change, at least my understanding, was that the changes were expected as of January 1, and that they would extend through the period described in 2018. And I believe the wisdom of the group was, and I wasn't again involved, but with the actual testimony, was to give us time to really thoughtfully look at this issue, but in the meantime, get enough resources into the primary care and behavioral health clinics to make sure that the care was provided. So that reimbursement parity was to start as of January 1.
Yeah, I just want to clarify that Section 2 is the applicability clause, and there's a Subsection 1, there's a Subsection 2. Subsection 1 is dealing with practitioners who have a contract with an insurer, and obviously we can't, under the state constitution, impair the rights under the contract. So the it would only apply to services provided under contracts entered into or renewed after that date. Well, whereas for out-of-network providers, it's in effect beginning January 1, 2014.
So I know that in most of our areas, because of knowledge of that contract, and most contracts commenced on the 1st, so that language was included. But I'm sure that there are some where there may have been a longer term to that contract. Any other things that, any other questions?
Mr. Co-Chair, I just want to mention the reporting that the task force needs to give a little update here shortly, and then the timeline for the final report is outlined in the bill as well. Mm-hmm. So, map it out accordingly.
So we will be, as Sandy says, doing reports for this session as well as the subsequent sessions. And again, the purpose or intention, at least as I read through the bill, is to promote maintenance and expansion of primary care and mental health workforce, as well as ensure a fair compensation system. So that's a fairly broad range of territory that we can venture into. Any other questions? Great.
Okay.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
At this point, what we wanted to do was to open it up for discussion with the panel, and discussion particularly given light of the sort of possible broad scope of this group. We clearly have some definite deliverables in that we are going to be submitting the reports and recommendations over a period of time. But the scope of those reports and how we look at it will largely be determined by, again, this group and how broad we are willing to look and how daring we are willing to be in recommendations or in our discussion. And this does encompass both primary care and behavioral health. This does not address hospital reimbursement, specialty care reimbursement, but is really focused on primary care and behavioral health. So that is our scope. I just wanted to say a couple of things, and Mary had some comments that to sort of start our discussion. In that many of us view this as a significant opportunity that has been afforded really by the wisdom of those who really crafted the final language to allow this discussion. I oversee and work much with the Medicaid population, as well as I also oversee our charity population for our health system. And there is really a significant need to improve access and effective delivery of primary care and behavioral health in certainly in our region, and I think that's also reflected throughout the state. Areas of access differ from county to county, but in general, as we look at our counties, all but two are considered medically underserved. And so as a state in general, we have the need to make sure that we have a workforce. Part of that workforce clearly is affected by reimbursement for services that are provided. So as I looked at this opportunity, and as Mary and I had a chance to talk about this, we felt that this would be a great venue over the next several months to have a thoughtful dialogue. First, to look at what is our provider need, and where are those areas in which we do need to put attention to it. What are the care models that really best support a patient-centered model of care? As we've talked about a lot of different types of models, there's clear evidence that team-based models deliver significantly more effective care, decrease admission to the emergency room and hospital admission, as well as readmission even for those with chronic disease. For those of us that work in an environment where I'm highly dependent on advanced care practitioners as my partners on my team, I want to make sure that our teams are supported and the reimbursement is part of that. So I have a personal vested interest to make sure my team stays very viable and can effectively deliver the care. The other opportunity we have is really to look at how we can support outcomes as opposed to a fee-for-service or visit-based model. This is, we're continuing to not necessarily put lipstick on a pig, but we're really trying to address up something that we know is not working. I think we have an opportunity to fundamentally look at some ways that we could potentially structure payment systems within the state to reward the types of behaviors for both on the patient side and on the provider side that can lead to improved health. As we've looked at the cost of healthcare, there's no question in my mind that we are expending more and more money because we are becoming less and less healthy as a country and as a state. And as we see the rates of diabetes, drug use, alcohol, tobacco, significant effects of behavioral health, over 28% in the latest statistics of all of us will experience some sort of significant mental health issue over the course of this year. If we don't have workforce to help address those issues, we're going to struggle to deal with that. We also have issues related to the effects of mental health on physical health. And there's no question that particularly in the population that's heavily disadvantaged with significant disability related to mental health issues, their life expectancy is dramatically less. The cost of care for them on the medical side, not just on the behavioral health side, but on the medical side, is phenomenally greater than the cost of someone without those same problems. So this is, I think, an opportunity to have a thoughtful dialogue. And are there ways that we can help our legislature to look at payment models across the state? And so with that, I know Mary has some passion around this as well. And then we'd like to open it up for some dialogue. And we'd like to get a sense from the group, make sure that the group is willing to look at a broader range, and we're not just here to put a rubber stamp on the parity issue from 2018 on, but actually to look thoughtfully at the payment restructure. So,
well, I agree with everything that Dr. Kincaid had to say. I think the biggest issues, and you've all identified them, is what are the provider needs in the state? I mean, we have information to gather, and we need to get recent information, not what was done a couple years ago. What are the access? Who's using what care models? What does the workforce look like in the particular parts of the state? If we're going to put this all together, we need to serve the whole state. And also look at other states, even though right now it sounds like Oregon's the only one that's doing this. Also find out, are there other committees, are there other folks within the system itself that are looking at this? We're not reinventing the wheel. But I think getting the most current data for all of us, we all know sitting here, we're all impassioned healthcare, or we want to serve. We all know the need is there, but show us the numbers, show us how we can do it. The payers can show us how much they're paying in various parts of the state, what the difference is, those sort of things. So getting all of that information together, I think, will be huge, and then it'll allow us to make some very good decisions about where we need to be. So
where is that information going to come from? I think Janine, Dr. Smith would be the one to let us know.
Well, we have some. We don't have all of the data, perhaps, that everyone always wants. But the Office of Analytics, now sort of separate from the Office of Health Policy, has the workforce database, that has some statistics in terms of what we're getting off the licensing process, which we do in partnership with the Center for Nursing and the Workforce Institute. I think we tried to go down some previous earlier discussions about what we could pull out of all payer, but again, that's a little premature, I think, to get detailed payment. It might be a little more of a challenge. There certainly is a lot of work going on around patient-centered primary care home. I know John and I were both part of the recent primary care consensus around supporting the patient-centered primary care home standards across almost nearly all of the domestic carriers and CCOs were represented at that table, along with the family practice, pediatrics, nursing association, OMA, hospital association. So we can certainly try to gather some of the sort of more easily reachable information and maybe bring that back to the February meeting and then see what other needs are from there.
Additional comment?
So I served on a different work group. Sandy was our able-bodied administrator, and we love her, so we're going to enjoy having her for this. Keeps us all on task. And I think, you know, I guess one of the things as we move through this is there were other groups that wanted to be included in this bill. I think it's really important. I'm sorry if I missed this already when I stepped out, my computer died. But I think that it's important to, as we go through this process, that we are thoughtful about what this conversation looks like for others. And the mm-hmm. group that we served on before was midwifery. And so, you know, and of course, there's those same tensions in other groups as well, whether it's chiropractors or whoever. You know, as we look at, even if we had all the money to do healthcare the way, you know, people envision that they want to do it, we still don't have enough people. So for me, issues around both scope and payment, I think are really critical. And so as we go through this, if there are things that apply that we learn along the way that solve this issue for where there's some of those other tensions amongst other practitioners in healthcare, I think I'd like us to be mindful of that as we work.
Thank you. I've been having a lot of different thoughts about this since we started this conversation. Coming from Central Oregon, which was name-checked, I was sitting here thinking in great horror, yes, I remember when the two child psychiatrists left. And yes, I recall that right now we're in recruitment for child psychiatrists and have been for the last 2 years with no end in sight. I come from Central Oregon, one of the greatest places on the planet to live. And in terms of mental health services, the absence of providers is stunning. Mm-hmm. We are the great home of people who will come shut up boutique shops and take cash-only practices and see those of means and those within our Medicaid population and those in our commercially insured populations cannot be seen. And the nurse practitioners and PAs within our community have been those who've stepped up time and time again and taken those hits and been some of the people who have stepped up to the plate and rescued us at times when things have been most dark. So I'm grateful that we're having this conversation, because we can't have these folks continue to practice in these environments of shifting, changing costs. And while I understand and appreciate Tom Holt's commentary about the move to global budgets, I have worked very closely with the Central Oregon Health Council and the CCO. Very, very interested in team-based care, very interested in the global budget, very much would like to take fee-for-service and show it its way out the door. I also am a realist, and I understand that that's not going to happen overnight. And there has to be some form of how we level the playing field, both for hospitals and for providers, to be able to do this in a way that people can sustain. Because it's not like healthcare reform isn't a light switch. You don't just turn it on one day and go, wow, we're all going to be on a global budget. It doesn't exactly work that way. It's going to take us a long time to get there. And I so appreciate Representative Parrish, you bringing up, and I think others have addressed this mildly, but the issue of scope. I'm going to give you a few cases in point. St. Charles Health System has a very robust system of embedding behavioral health practitioners, primarily psychologists, into primary care clinics. That has gotten them a national reputation
for improved patient outcomes, lower cost of care. We've been able to see it across a variety of different areas. But let me tell you, in the CCO world, where this hits us. There's this thing called the quality incentive metric. I'm sure you've all heard about it at some point. We refer to them as the lovely quality incentive metrics. Adolescent well visits. When you look at a pediatric provider clinic and say, okay, I want you now to see these adolescent well visits that are primarily mental health visits. We're checking in to see if you're suicidal, depressed, et cetera, et cetera. We want you to come in now once a year in a capitated model where you've not necessarily been seeing folks in that mechanism before. And, oh, wait for it, only this provider credential is going to get credit for it, right? Only one type of provider credential. In a team-based care model, an adolescent well visit might easily and be better served by a behavioral health practitioner who, unfortunately, due to their scope and due to our own coding systems, doesn't qualify to be able to check the box of that code to give that clinic credit in a team-based care model. Adolescent well, developmental child visits, follow-up for ADHD medication, some of those types of things are things that in a team-based care model the physician can do, but if you look at 17 quality incentive metrics, can you really expect the physician to do all of that? So we have to really look at not only our fiscal model, but our scope at the same time, and I hope that becomes the purview of the work we do here.
Robin, as a leader of a hospital, when you're recruiting physicians, is the issue of reimbursement in Oregon and in your specific market a factor in the sense of they can point to another market in the country and say, I can get paid more there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially in a market like ours where, as a health system, and we are the only health system in Central Oregon, and we're seeing record decreases in commercial insurers, increase in Medicaid, decrease in charity care. But absolutely, I've had physicians look at me and say, well, you're offering me $200,000 here. I can go over here, and I can get $275,000. And I can't meet it. It's not possible. Especially when we also have to deal with we're a facility that serves a broad rural care area. So when I'm talking with a provider, I'm saying, understand that you're responsible not just for Bend and the beautiful thing that is Bend, but you're responsible for the pristine Madras and the absolutely fabulous Prineville and the really lovely community of Lapine and all of these places that are so important to us. And you're looking at these providers and saying, I'd like you to get in a car and drive to Prineville. And they're going, I can't make a model work that way. No, we're going to pay you for that. It's very much outside the physician, especially in psychiatry, because there are places, and I sat for a long time in the American Hospital Association's task force for behavioral health, and I would listen to my psychiatric friends in Boston tell me about how they were embedding psychiatrists in primary care and how all these primary care clinics have these psychiatrists in them, and I'm like, I'd just pay to have a psychiatrist in Central Oregon, much less one in every primary care clinic. But in Boston, you can throw a stone and hit a psychiatrist. In Central Oregon, you could probably throw a bomb and not get one within, 25 miles.
Can I add to that, though, in that, when you talk about the discrepancy of $200,000 to $275,000, I'm going to go take this job over here, and there's some other factors that are ones we're not talking about, and it's not in our purview in this committee to do that, but when you're looking at the tax rate of this state compared to other states, that $275,000 actually is a lot more money against $200,000 here in the highest tax rate. And then you're also looking at the incentives to get people into healthcare professions that other states are offering, whether it's student loan deductibility or kind of a whole slew of mechanisms to get people moving that direction that, frankly, are not as robust here or we're not as interested in doing here, or loan forgiveness or whatever, that it does make it more attractive to go other places and practice. Not only are we not offering, the compensation, but the other peripherals that make it more enticing to go do medicine in Texas or, Iowa or somewhere where my cousin's a cardiologist there. So yeah.
Well, and when you talk to the issue of loan reimbursements, I tried that a few years ago. We did loan reimbursements where we would sign five-year contracts and say, okay, you're going to stay for 5 years. We're going to reimburse your loan, et cetera, et cetera. Guess what happens when the 5 years are up.
They're gone.
And that's the reality of what we're seeing and dealing with right now. We have to find a different way and a different way to incentivize providers to stay. And it can't all be about money.
I think that point very well taken. As we've looked at that same issue, it isn't just about money, certainly in our area. And if you look statistically, the Pacific Northwest in general has lower salary ranges than many parts of the United States. And obviously we have a beautiful place to live, so that's what you try to market. I think there are some other mechanisms that people have used to try to enhance that. I think that the care model itself is an attractant. And so the question is that can we build in this state a care model that actually works for providers? In our community, we've lost approximately 20%, almost 24% of our providers in the last 18 months in primary care. And largely because of actually retirement. Not because of the fact that we can't replace them. These are providers that trained in an era in which I'm a family doctor, and when I finished training, 40 of my classmates out of 100 went into primary care. Last year, in my medical school class turned out 4. Mm-hmm. So just to give you a perspective around primary care and behavioral health is even scarier. So as far as the number of psychiatrists that actually are being able to be trained. And so, again, what is it about the care model in Oregon that is attractive to those that do choose to do primary care? And part of it has to be how you support that care model. And as we shift to a different type of care model, it will require a different reimbursement than the standard fee-for-service reimbursement. And I think that that is a perspective that we are going to have to address. But the shortage is kind of multifactorial, and certainly our economy does have an impact. Additional comment?
I would just like to say that I'm glad that we're going to look at a larger scope of the issue rather than just set some fees and move on from there. I hope as we do that, part of what both team-based practice requires and really kind of transforming what we're going to do in healthcare requires that we also value some other things in practice, like the cognitive side of things, planning, care coordination, thinking ahead, getting at the front end of disease, not at the back end. That requires a different way of looking at things that today's current models don't allow us to reimburse for. We still have to recognize that although we still have to sustain people to get through the transition, we also have to have a way of valuing the cost of things. Mm-hmm. And so while we don't want the fee-for-service model to drive things, we'll probably always be talking in some way about what unit cost is. We have to try to figure out how to do that. And then lastly, as we try to develop methods, we have to remember that Medicare and CMS through Medicaid are still large payers that often drive a lot of reimbursement policy across the country and across providers. And so I hope we can find a way to be flexible to be able to lead, and yet when others come up with other ideas and good ways of doing it, we can incorporate it in without, further legislation if possible and have a smooth transition in the future.
We do have some data we'll try to bring to the group as well. There's been a lot of actually very good work as I've looked back at some of the different task force and commissions that have come out of even the legislative process over the last several years. They've looked at workforce, they've looked at primary care, they've looked at behavioral health integration and some of those issues. And we'll want to take that work that's been done and not necessarily try to replicate it, but actually just learn from it. So I think as we bring this, the work, we'd like to be able to, this is a body that is really going to look at multiple factors and then try to come up with some recommendations that might assist our legislature as it goes forward. So any additional comments?
I just had a side comment about the people, how to incentivize people coming into Oregon. One thing I did read, which was interesting, was that Oregon is the number one state people are moving into right now. So it is the number one state, so you've got a lot of people coming here. Maybe we'll get more incentives that way. Who knows?
I always worry about those types of statistics. again, you can create all sorts of conjecture based on percentages. But you know, we like to hope that we offer something that's attractive. And again, I think that we do have some significant workforce issues, and it isn't all about workforce. It's really about that also outcomes. What is it that we're actually paying for? And I think that that's a piece, I think, at least, and I work with our insurance colleagues, that's they're very concerned about that aspect. That's what they're held accountable for, and that's actually what the consumer is asking for. So, yeah.
Yeah, I do think, you know, adding on to that point, so I saw some of those stats about the move into mm-hmm. Oregon, but a lot of that move is going into Portland. So mm-hmm. the Portland metro mm-hmm. area has growth. Lots of other parts of the state aren't feeling the same piece of it. And I do think it's interesting when you look at the physician community in Portland, there are some specialties I would actually argue there's a surplus of physicians that actually, you know, would be well for the marketplace that they actually dispersed. And then you go outside of Portland, literally 20 miles, and then all of a sudden you have a completely different dynamic. So I think when you talk about the state, you know, I do a lot of work in Eugene, and the groups I work with there, they're at capacity. I mean, there's no room for creativity. They're looking to recruit doctors. They're really batting down the hatch. In Portland, there are folks that have a lot of capacity and are looking for new ways to get more customers. So really two different worlds there. And the more people move to Oregon and focus on Portland, that issue creates a unique dynamic.
Yeah. And I do agree with that because I also work down in Medford and they're having a heck of a time trying to get coverage down in Medford as well. So I go anywhere from Battleground, Washington to Medford, and you're right, 20 miles here or there, you're in a totally different place.
That's why I think that when we address the scope issue, mm-hmm. I mean, if primary care physicians with their training, it just economically makes mm-hmm. sense for them to go into specialties, and so mm-hmm. they will, or they'll go to a different part of the... And so if we're looking at scope, then I think it's extremely important for us to make sure that the practitioners that are able to deliver health care can work to the top of their practice act, as well as get then reimbursed adequately mm-hmm. for that. So that would be part of our mission.
Mm-hmm. I do know that the American Academy of PAs have been doing a huge modernization move towards trying to make that an actual event, having everybody that's, you know, a mid-level advanced practitioner, whatever you want to call them, practice at their highest ability and be usable, you know, effectively.
And there are many factors as well related to even some of the changes that were brought in with high tech and some of the incentive payments around medical record systems mm-hmm. and those types of things that have influenced the way we practice. And so I think as we go forward, we'll have to understand, you know, what is that dynamic and can you actually leverage technology or is technology actually just an added cost? So I think that as we look at that, I think those are types of some of the issues that we'll want to make sure that we try to support practices that really are able to demonstrate that it's better care and better outcomes. So what I'm going to do just briefly, and hopefully we'll be able to end prior to 4 o'clock, is... that's my one, though. Maxine took all the rest. What I'd like to do is we've put together sort of just a mock extremely high-level work plan for the life of this group as... We know that we'll have several months, so to speak, in which to actually look at this in the life of this committee or this task force. Mm-hmm. And so want to just walk through high level and get comment. Again, there have been several good suggestions today around getting some additional information, workforce issues related to the breadth of practitioners that provide these types of services within our state. So we'll try to bring some of those things. So as we've kind of mapped out, sort of again at a very high level, our next meeting, Dr. Smith has been kind enough to really look look at the care model discussion, and we'll bring some of the work that's actually been done by our task force colleagues and other task force and other committees, and we'll try to bring as much of that material as well. We'll also bring some data around the workforce. What are we really talking about? How many providers of the different types of providers are we talking about in the workforce? And then we'll look at some of the current payment models and some of the payment models that exist in other parts of the United States and the other parts of perhaps even the world to look at are there things we can learn from that that might be applicable for our population. We again are a very progressive state, I'll have to say, with respect to looking at a lot of these things. We're small enough that we have some level of being nimble and being able to do some things that other states. We also have leadership that is committed to changing the way that we deliver healthcare. And so that's tremendously advantageous both at the state level, and then we have national leadership that also is clearly attentive to trying to meet the needs in the healthcare arena. So I want to try to leverage that. So we'll try to bring in as much of that material as we can. As we go forward, we will, again, look at some of the experience within the state. Our hope is just to put this out as a potential sort of roadmap. We'll adjust as different topics will take us more time or less time than perhaps we've allotted originally. So wanted to open up for comment. There are things that you see there that you don't want to talk about, things that you would like to bring into the play earlier rather than later. Be happy to entertain that. Any thoughts or comments? Again, it's very, very high level, so just to give us a rough idea. We will be submitting, one of our requirements is to submit a report to this upcoming session in February. Obviously, that report will be detailed about the multiple meetings that we've had, but we'll certainly... We certainly will give our intent and what our discussion has been.
And it, too, will be very high level.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Guaranteed to that. We have not had time to dive into the weeds. So any comment around the work plan?
It's thoughtful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, Cindy just reminded me that should you have it's an amazing surge of electric energy in your cortex that you will in the night you will send that to Mary and I or Sandy, and we'll try to again incorporate it. So if there's things that you really think about later on you want to bring into the discussion, then I really ask you to do so. And again, as we think of our you know, really the folks that we had speaking to us, Brian, Sarah, if there are things that you feel that you're going to certainly want to bring to the table, and we'll send the information to Tom to make sure that we get as much input from our associations as possible for the people that actually represent the providers. We want to bring as much of that information into our discussion as possible as well, and I know they'll help us a lot with some of the workforce issues. Certainly have had a lot of internal surveys and different things that both organizations have done to really look at some of the workforce challenges, so we'll definitely bring that to the table.
I have a question.
Yeah.
In February, you have review of scope, discussion, defined deliverables. Is that mainly around, is it going to include all providers, or are we going to have it narrowed to physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, or are we going to include psychologists, clinical social workers?
Again, the your question, you're right, your question around scope and the different types of practitioners. The bill itself, you know, obviously just focused in on really E&M coding specific to those particular providers. As we go forward, that's what we need to decide. And okay. So that's why You know, I thought we'd have, I wasn't sure we would be ready to make that decision at this point.
No.
So I think as we come back, we have to understand what does that mean and sort of how granular are we going to get. Again, we're talking about recommendations potentially for broad legislative frameworks as opposed to specific line items of payment. As we look at that, you know, we just have to understand the workforce and then how is it that we create a framework or at least assistance for legislatures in providing that sort of legislative framework for that delivery of care. Because we can't get down to, you know, we're going to pay Susie this much and mm-hmm. Betty that much and Fred that much. That's not going to, that won't work. At least as I look at it. Tobo, I think that would be the discussion. So we'll bring back a list of the types of providers that potentially could be included in this discussion. And then we'll have some dialogue around that as well.
Thank you.
I would like to know from the group, from a communication standpoint, again, we've been trying to communicate via email. I want to make sure that we can do some connection and education even between our times together because it's very, you know, we have just a short time. I want to make sure we get as much information to you as possible, and I'm assuming that, doing that via email is going to work the best.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And if I may interject, Mr. Co-Chair, first of all, did everybody have a chance to look at the member roster that I sent out? If that information is accurate, great. If it's inaccurate, let me know. If you want to add additional contact information, let me know. I will update this document and then make that available to you. And also, as far as communication, email is great, but for those of you who are not familiar with OLIS, if after we gavel out you want to stick around, I will show you, because I think if folks can access OLIS on the general information, it will eliminate a lot of the email attachment back and forth stuff, mm-hmm. and you can go to a central place. But then, of course, if you prefer to do the email, but we do have some technology that might be helpful in folks going to one place to get, you know, the same information instead of multiple emails. So. I'm here for that.
And Sandy, if you could clarify the date at which we need to send our current report to the Health Policy Commission. Do you know that date?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, it will be before the end of the February session, which technically would be the end of February, but they do have latitude to go into March 7th, the first Friday in March. So we're not quite sure, so no later than the 7th, and it will go to both the House and the Senate Health Care Committees, which the House meets Monday, Wednesday, Friday. The Senate meets Monday, Tuesday, Thursday. So
I think that being chair of the Senate Health Policy Committee,
right.
I think that Monday, so that you would only have to come one time.
Right.
And so it would, and I would prefer to have it that last Monday in February is my preference, because
right.
who knows when will signee die. But it could, we could be efficient and get out early.
So most likely that we'll actually have that in process and then have some discussion. That'll be something we'll probably want to move back and forth across the group.
And If I may be so direct and bold, your report may...
So far in my experience with you, I know you to mean nothing else.
We are on the record.
Mm-hmm. I can attest to that.
Great. I'm thinking that the report will be that we really don't have a report, but this is what we've outlined for the next several meetings. Mm-hmm. So it should be pretty straightforward.
Very good. Very good. We do want to make sure we dot our I's and cross our T's and make sure we meet our legislative requirements there. Very good. So we'll take care of that. We have a couple of other items that we are going to want to talk about, but mainly they're sort of housekeeping things around our next scheduled meeting. And I think we can do that after we gavel out. Is that okay, or do we need to set the date prior to that?
No, that's up to you if you want to do it on the record or not.
Okay. All right. I think, are there any other comments? at this point before we adjourn.
But you can't leave once you adjourn.
Yes, I'm going to ask you to just stay around for a few minutes while we do some other just housekeeping.
This, Janine, maybe what we can do afterwards is find out how to get onto that website, but that there is a workforce committee of the Oregon Health Policy Board that's done a lot of work that I don't know if everyone on the committee is aware of, and they've looked at the data, and so I want to make sure that those documents can be available to the committee, because that's the purpose of that committee. It was set in statute when Mona Sanderson and others passed House Bill 2009, so it's a resource to us.
Yeah, and we'll make sure that those are out, because it is an excellent resource, and it does point out some of our limitations and the things that have been very challenging for us as a state, many of which have been mentioned here today.
One other comment. This morning, I call it the Rural Health Care Task Force Incentive, something like that, that met this morning, and some of the topics that we touched on, they are looking at all of the incentives we have to retain, and we have a lot, but to retain providers within this state. And there's a wealth of information from that has been delivered to us at that task force also.
Very good. So we will definitely want to tap into that, perhaps even have maybe their chair come and share some of those things. Okay. Any other comment for the good of the order? Okay, hearing none, we'll gavel out and we'll adjourn this meeting.